Two of my favorite guests on the entire planet are Dr. Phil, Reverend Dr. Phil DeLong, and Frank Fischina, who is from, they're both from Florida. And of course, they've both had their, Frank Fischina's been following the Flatwood Monster story. It's 67 years, 67th anniversary of this incident that took place in West Virginia. Some of you maybe see some of it on TV. Don't believe what you see on TV. Some of the shows have portrayed things. And so Frank wanted to know if he could come on and talk about it. He's welcome anytime to come on here. Frank Fischina and Reverend Dr. Phil DeLong. How are you guys doing?
Doing good, TJ. Glad to be back on board again.
Doing good, TJ, and thank you for having us on the show.
It is always my pleasure to have both of you on. You guys are friends, have been friends. Can you tell me a little bit how you guys became friends and things like that?
I know Dr. Phil from when he started out in Volusia County. Dr. Phil's a trained psychic and healer and metaphysicist. Is that the correct word, Phil?
Yes.
Yeah, I said that word right without stuttering. But I met Dr. Phil, and Dr. Phil has an office up in Casadega Spiritualist Camp here in Florida, and I met Dr. Phil at his first office.
So how did that come about?
Just by chance, fate, whatever you want to call it. I just happened to meet Phil, and we hit it off. We started talking about UFO stuff. And that was, what, about 7 years ago, Phil? Approximately?
Yeah, that is correct.
About 7 years ago.
And we were also involved in a paranormal show.
Right, here in Daytona Beach.
Yep.
Yeah, at the Museum of Arts and Science. Met Phil there. We had a brief meeting, and then we met over. We were each given a lecture and stuff like that. And we hit it off, and we started working together and became friends.
And Phil, your background, metaphysical, can you give us a little bit about your background, please?
Yeah, my background as far as being psychic or medium started when I was a child. I had two near-death experiences, one when I was 12 and the other one when I was 19. And that more or less gave me a more metaphysical and psychic abilities. I was always studying it. And the real thing is it's all about the power of the mind and how one bends time and space.
And so you've worked with people over the years to help people heal. And I know you belong to different groups and organizations, and you've had training, shamanistic training, and many different types of other training, right?
That is correct.
Okay. So with that being said, we've identified who and of course, Frank, he's been, where are you from originally, Frank? Because you don't have a Florida accent.
I'm from Connecticut.
I figured it was somewhere up, you know, in the Northeast. You've got kind of a Northeastern sound to you.
Yeah. So, or I should say yes. Well, yeah, I grew up Stratford, Connecticut, just outside of Bridgeport, and I went to College of Pair School of Art in New Haven.
Okay, so we're going to talk about, first of all, the Flatwoods Monster, and you're going to refresh us, Frank, with all the information that you dug up. When did this event happen, and how did it happen, and then all the years you spent researching it. This was 1952, right, when it first happened, right?
Correct. It happened on September 12th, 1952. They're in what has been called the Year of the Saucers. And Project Blue Book had more recorded UFO sightings and unknowns during that year than any other year in its 17-year existence. And I just stumbled onto the case. I have some relatives that lived in Frametown, which is in Braxton County, a few miles away from Flatwoods. And I went up for a funeral, and that's how I found out about this thing, was through a newspaper article. And I went into town with my cousin, and that's for the first time. That was back in September of 1991, and that's when I saw the big sign, "Welcome to Flatwoods, home of the Green Monster." And that's what triggered it off. CJ. From there, I just started researching before the internet. So everything I researched on the onset was just old flying saucer books, trying to find periodicals, magazines, and whatnot. And the one thing that I found odd about the whole case is I read about 50 different stories, TJ, and no two of them were alike. The story had become so botched up over the years, and word of mouth, the story was completely lost. And that's when I started going back up into West Virginia for the next several years, or I should say decades, interviewing people and finding more out about the story.
So what, I mean, you know, it's one thing to want to find out about something, but why did you have such a fire lit in your belly to, I mean, is it just something that kept, the process kept getting bigger, you got to know people, and then you became more connected? It just evolved?
It started out just as a little hobby and going up to West Virginia and talking to people, and I went to film school down here. An associate's degree in film school for 2 years, and I started working on a little project. At that point, I was trained in camera operation, and I started going back and forth up to West Virginia interviewing the different people, because, you know, this happened in 52, and I was interviewing the majority of the people in the early 90s into mid-90s and late 90s, and I was trained at that point of how to conduct interviews, how to work cameras, lighting. So at the beginning, it wasn't too easy. What actually piqued my interest more than anything, more than a monster, is when you would walk into town and just kind of cold call ask about it, and the people were more disturbed about the case and their reactions than anything else. And just seeing that kind of piqued my curiosity that I wanted to look into a little bit more. And then as I started getting involved in it, I was granted an interview with Kathleen May, who was a primary witness involved in the case. She was the closest one who saw the Flatwoods Monster Machine. And she put me in touch with other people. And before you know it, I was trying to get these interviews. And a couple times, guns were drawn. I was shown guns. To get the hell out of town, and I loved it when they called me boy, get out of town boy, we don't talk about that goddamn monster up here no more. So it was quite unnerving being an outsider, and like you said earlier in the show, when I would open my mouth up and start talking, immediately they knew I was not from West Virginia. Mm-hmm. And added into the mix of making it harder to get an interview. But once I got involved with Kathleen, and she saw how serious I had become involved in this, and I got the Project Blue Book documents out from the Flatwoods case in September 12th, 13th, and that's when I really started running with the ball, TJ. And I printed all this stuff out, and I gave copies of it to Kathleen, and before you know it, she's making phone calls of all the people that were involved in it. A lot of them weren't recorded or in the history books about this case. There was so much behind the scenes and behind the curtain going on, and Kathleen basically hooked me up with the different individuals. And probably two of the other biggest interviews I got were with Colonel Dale Levitt, United States Army, retired, and he was the former sheriff of Braxton County in the 60s, and he was a hard ass, TJ. And I was nervous to talk to him, and he wanted nothing to do with it at the beginning because he was basically sworn to secrecy. He actually went up to the crash site and retrieved some of the pieces and some of the samples on the Bailey Fisher farm. And Kathleen called up, and for lack of better words, she put a good word in for me and told Dale how serious I was about this. And after repeated phone calls and showing up at his door several times, sometimes I would just pop in. I think he got sick of looking at me. So he did an interview with me on the farm, and but he wouldn't allow me to tape it. And then eventually, about a year later, he spoke to me about it, and I brought a Sony Handycam camera up there at the time, which I had available, and I did a full-blown interview with Colonel Leavitt. And then a little bit later, I interviewed Ailee Stewart Jr., who was a Johnny on the spot involved in the Flatwoods case. He was the first person of authority to go up to the farm. And I drove up to North Carolina, and I interviewed Stewart. And as far as I know, that's the only interview since the incident happened. He moved out of West Virginia, moved to North Carolina. And I have a full-blown interview with him. And all this stuff can be seen on YouTube on my documentary that I put together. So what happened is, once I started interviewing people, I was getting recommended to talk to the next few people, and I was showing them all the documents, and I showed them how upsetting the story had become, because no two stories were the same. And before you know it, I came out with a book in 2004. Then I came out with a couple subsequent books that were updated versions. So we're constantly finding updated material, TJ.
Still to this day, after 28 years.
Yep, still going at it.
I was going to bring Dr. Phil on this because the two of you became friends. And Dr. Phil, were you aware of the Flatwoods?
TJ, he just stepped out of the room.
Okay. We'll wait.
Here he is.
Okay.
He had to go get the tissue. Okay. He's back on.
Okay. Dr. Phil, I wanted to ask you, when you met Frank, were you aware of the Flatwoods incident? And then also, part two of this question is, you have the ability to sense things and see things. And what was, when you found out about this story, what did you feel about it? What do you feel was going on? If you could answer those two. Thank you.
Okay. When I met Frank, I did not know anything of the Flatwoods Monster incident. And Frank and I had talked about it. And I believe that it is a real thing, that these events happened. Being a psychic and a medium, you can see certain energies and entities around Frank. So in that astral realm, they are helping Frank to get the story out.
Yeah, we talked about that before, Dr. Phil. I remember you told me you saw some of those beings. What are those beings that were in that ship that crashed in Flatwoods? What did they look like? Can you describe them?
Well, it is what Frank has drawn, but you would say that mostly it's a reptilian-type entity with a long tail. But I believe these are benevolent beings. They're not really the reptilians that we would consider malevolent. So they came here to assist humanity. And I think humanity's misunderstanding of the situations is the response was either incorrect or they just didn't understand it.
Could it have been deliberate as well? Do you think that was a deliberate, they were well aware? You know, I guess I know that there's been others pulling at the strings for a long time, so they didn't want anybody here that was going to help us. Let's put it that way. So certain people did not want that.
Well, and they had the shoot them down orders. That was in July 29th, 1952, so if they can't talk, you know, these UFOs down, then shoot them down. But then we might have a communication problem.
Maybe. So in other words, shoot first and ask questions later.
Okay, so we've kind of laid out a lot of why, you know, we got into some of the details, and most people probably that have listened to my show. But Frank, if you can just go through a review of what happened that night and where these UFOs came from. Do you mind going through all that again, please? Just quickly, if you don't mind. It's at your own pace.
Yeah, sure. When I started researching the Flatwoods case, TJ, I was just looking in Braxton County in the Flatwoods area. Then I started talking to some of the locals who I met through Kathleen May and her son Freddie May, and they told me that there was a lot of UFOs that were seen throughout Braxton County. And I went into the archives and I started reading some of the research in the books and private papers of Gray Barker, who was one of the first investigators up there, and as well as Ivan T. Sanderson. And they spoke quite a bit about the UFOs that were seen throughout Braxton County that night. Besides Flatwoods, there was actually several UFOs sighted over the Flatwoods area. Then Sanderson's research brought me into the Baltimore area, where he wrote about UFOs that were seen in that area that night. So what I did is I got a map out and I started pinpointing this map, which I call it my master map. And it's on my website, TJ. I started plotting all of these points. Then I got my hands on the Blue Book files for September 12th. And I spent several years dissecting all the information out. And that's where some of the best info came from, because there were sightings all up and down the Eastern Seaboard that night. And it took a long time to separate all the different sightings and identify each craft, to identify and then give them numbers and figure out how many UFOs were seen that night and what directions they were flying in. I was able to figure out their trajectories, what times they were seen. I started looking into newspaper accounts. Then Stanton Friedman came on board, and he got some of the Barry Greenwood files and newspaper clippings, and he sent me a box that was a couple pounds filled with all these clippings. So I had hundreds and hundreds of different pieces of information that I had to segregate and put into a chronological order, and from that point forward, I was able to figure out what happened. And I actually worked in reverse on the Flatwoods case, because I didn't know where it began. Flatwoods is spoken about the little hub. It's the central part of the state in West Virginia. Well, I worked in reverse, and I worked with several different military people. I worked with police officers, air traffic control people. I worked with probably 100 different people. And one fellow in particular worked with me, and we figured out what happened by connecting the dots on my master map. And we were able to identify that there were four damaged objects that came in over the United States that night. Three of them came in over the Eastern Seaboard and split up into three separate areas. One came up from the vicinity of Florida that was damaged and was landing along the southern part of the United States. And to make a long story short, TJ, what the Flatwoods case was a search and rescue mission. There were four different damaged UFOs that came over the United States. The first three that came over the United States were flying erratically. They had pieces falling off of them. They were exploding, making multiple landings. And this is all documented heavily in my book. I have every single landing site, every location where these were things were seen, their times, trajectories, and I followed them into Braxton County. And what happened is the other craft that was damaged that came up from the direction of the Gulf of Mexico, and that involves our missing pilots, Jones and Del Curto, there was a rendezvous point fixed in Flatwoods. And that's why there were so many different UFOs sighted over Flatwoods and Braxton County, because when these two damaged ships came in, they were to be put down in the same area on the Bailey Fisher Farm. Well, what happened is the coordination was off by a few minutes, and one of the crafts, the one that came in from Florida, did not touch down on the farm at the same time. And like I said, this is all documented on my map, and you could zoom in and look at it. But what happened, it was a failed rescue mission. there were several other UFOs that came in over the eastern seaboard and from the direction of the south, and that's why there was such an abundance and an overwhelming amount of sightings. They were looking for the damaged craft, and there was a rendezvous that was missed. And what happened in the meantime is the one that touched down in Flatwoods is the one that contained the Braxton County Monster, which was a 12-foot-tall metallic machine. When that thing left its craft, it came across the Bailey Fisher Farm and hid up behind a tree. And at that point, the other craft that it was supposed to rendezvous with ended up going down the Elk River and crashed in Frametown near where my cousin's property was. Now, what's interesting is I knew this information, and it also ties into what Colonel Levitt, the colonel, told me, because he had a search and rescue party going down the Elk River looking for what he was told by the United States Air Force, a downed airplane. He broke away from there with a contingent of men, and he went into Flatwoods, cordoned off the area. And what happened is the Flatwoods incident had taken place already. This so-called monster got back into its craft, and it took off. And it followed the other one and went back down the Elk River. So in the meanwhile, all the police department, the sheriff's department, are running around with their, it looks like chickens with their heads cut off, trying to figure out what was going on. And the crafts had left already, but in the meantime, there were several other ones circling around the area. They were doing grid pattern searches, and the locals were just standing there looking up throughout Braxton County, and these things were flying at treetop level over their heads. And basically, that's what had happened in a nutshell. It was a search and rescue mission. And if you look at my master map, could see all the plotted points and trajectories and times. That took years, TJ. What I just said in 5 minutes,
right?
Took about 15 years to figure out, and 100 different people. But that's basically what everybody had missed. Nobody really looked outside of Flatwoods and Braxton County, and that's where the nuts of the story was. And there were sightings over 100 up and down the eastern seaboard, and there was approximately 20 and a half hours of sightings.
You mentioned that there were four craft that were damaged that you know of. How
right.
many? Any estimation of how many craft were seen? I guess that's probably a hard number to figure out. Any estimation? Because there must have been, what, tons of them, I would guess, in the skies.
Yeah. Actually, TJ, in the back of my book, I give an analytical breakdown of the amount of crafts. And I figured out from the initial four that were damaged and all the ones that were seen through the United States, 25. There were 25, including a mothership, which sat off the eastern seaboard, off the coast, sitting across from Delaware. And that was picked up and on radar, and that was actually in Project Blue Book. So the military people I work with, they really helped me out, because I'm not a military person. I was never in the service. But I was able to gather all this information up over the years, TJ, and then I sat down and was able to contact and have the right people with the correct background go through this and figure it out with me. I didn't do this all on my own, not by any stretch, but several people did. And most of them, their eyes popped out when they saw my initial map. Just working with several different people, air traffic controllers. I worked with about everybody you can imagine. And Stanton Friedman came into the case a little later on, and he helped tie all the loose ends together.
Let me ask you about Stanton, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Because he was a friend of yours, and I know he helped you a lot. And he passed away earlier this year. What do you want to tell me about Stanton? He seemed like a guy that was real dedicated to bringing the truth forward.
The one thing I could say right off the bat, and Stanton passed away in May of this year, and I spoke to him a few weeks before he passed away on the telephone, because I kept in touch with him quite often. And I could say I have never met a person in my life that had a memory like Stanton Friedman. I thought I had a good memory. And he was in his early 80s, and he was still rattling off quotes and facts and figures. And he, the last couple of times I spoke to him, he said, "Frank, I'm getting a little forgetful." And I said, "Stanton, you forgot more than most people will ever learn in a lifetime." Mm. And it, just talking to him on a personal level off the record, what you would see him giving a lecture was the tip of the iceberg. Because over the years, I met Stanton back in Gulf Breeze. It was a long time ago, TJ. It was the early to mid-90s. I met him at a conference. And I walked up to him for the first time, and as we spoke, I told him about my involvement with the Flatwoods Monster. And at that point, I was involved in it, TJ, maybe 3 or 4 years. And he froze in his tracks and asked me to wait. And when the crowd moved away from his table, I walked behind, and he said, "Frank, how did you get into those mountains?" He said, "We," referring to the UFO researchers and community, "have been trying to get into Braxton County and Flatwoods for years." At that point, you know, it was about 40 years. I says, "I have relatives up there." And I had to prove myself to Kathleen May, and he was amazed that I spoke and interviewed Kathleen with Kathleen May. And from that point, we kept in touch. And he ended up getting involved with me because literally, TJ, I was sending him stuff in the mail. Now, this is before all the internet and emails. I was sending packages to him, sending him my notes. I was sending him all kinds of stuff, photographs of my maps. And then we would talk on the phone for hours, and we were going over this. And I was giving him updates in between. And at a point, it got to be really crazy, because the more information I found, then I started doing radio interviews, and more people were contacting me. I'm sending Stanton all this stuff, and he was really intrigued with it. And he couldn't believe the amount of information I had. And he didn't realize how much stuff was written up in Blue Book. He was back in 1947 with Roswell and doing his other research books, but Flatwoods was forgotten about. And if I hadn't got involved in it, it would have been long gone, because the main part of my story was with the interviews with Colonel Levitt, Mrs. May, and Ailey Stewart Jr. They were the primaries, and they've all passed away, and I have them on audio and video recordings. But anyways, Stanton got involved with, this was even before my first book came out in 04. We had a little festival and gathering in Flatwoods for the 50th anniversary, and Stanton flew in from his home into Flatwoods, and he was actually up on the site for the 50th anniversary. And he said a few words, and we kind of kicked the whole weekend off. And we were there right at about 7:20 when the craft touched down on the Bailey Fisher Farm. And we walked down to where the incident took place, which was approximately 8 o'clock. And I always remember Stanton saying to me, and if you listen to our past shows, he said there was nothing like being there, and all the skeptics, and I don't even want to say the primary skeptic's name, because I still get upset over him, because he upset Stanton quite a few times. The people who are never actually up on the spot are the ones with the biggest mouths, and they have no idea what happened. But Stanton would always say, once you got up to that spot and you looked around, and for a man of Stanton's age, he walked over a mile up through the mountains into the back to where the craft actually touched down. And Stanton had a private walkthrough and step by step of what happened. And once you're up there, then you can really understand what happened. And that's what Stanton was amazed at. Later on that weekend, Stanton met Kathleen May, which you could see there's some pictures on the internet, and he spoke with Kathleen, and he also met Freddie May, Edison May, and I believe Ronnie Shaver, another one of the witnesses. So as far as a professional, active UFO researcher, Stanton was actually there, and I was up there for several years. I don't know who's been up there since, not too many, because it's property's owned, it's privately owned, doctor has the property. But Stanton met the main participants, as well as I, and we were on that spot. And Stanton actually did a shoot with me for Monster Quest.
Right.
Stanton was up on the site, and then we all went to the tree on the Fisher Farm, and then we went over into Frametown, and that's where we did a main portion of that interview. And Alfred Lemberg was working with Stanton and I during that whole, it was about a week shoot. So Stanton was involved quite heavily, and he helped me out quite a bit and with the documents. But once he got up there, that's when he really understood the story and it all made sense to him.
I want to ask Dr. Phil, you know, Stanton passed in May. I don't know if you communicate or connect with, I'm guessing you connect with any spirits. Because, you know, every life is a purpose, and I'm sure his life, his purpose was that. But can you sense Stanton be around at all? Is he still hanging around with Frank? Has he moved on? Do you have anything on that, Dr. Phil?
Well, his presence is always around Frank, and I feel it when I come and see Frank. And I had the pleasure of being on a radio show with Stanton maybe a couple years ago with Frank, and basically he took up the whole airtime. But Stanton Friedman is an astrophysicist. So when we look at metaphysics and everything, there's three things that we have to do, and it's generally what science is all about. We observe things, we evaluate it, and we prove everything. So that's the one thing that Stanton brings to Frank, and it is the awareness of truth when you follow those principles that comes out. So that's what Stanton's here for, that presence. It's the truth is out there. Sorry about that.
But that's okay. That's good. It's a good way to put it.
The truth is out there, but, you know, Stanton is still saying, you know, stick to that theory, you know, observe, evaluate, and prove everything.
What is to become of this? Do you think that, and back to you again, Dr. Phil, if you don't mind, and Frank, I'll get you in a moment, but because Frank's on the research end of it, and he's into the scientific and trying to find as much evidence, but you're on more of the where I kind of like to go. And do you think that this is ever going to be mainstream, that people are understand this event? Is there going to come a time when we will accept other beings and it'll be known to the public, and also these kind of stories will come forward?
I believe we're just on the cusp of that happening, because we've had a momentum going about the disclosure type energy, and things are coming out. It's just that nothing is ever, you know, put together. It's everything is piecemeal. Now, things can happen. For example, the Flatwoods movie might make some awareness of this incident. But once you get an awareness, you get an opening of the mind. And then people are going to search for more information. And then that is where the disclosure is going to finally be revealed. Right now, it's a lot of piecemeal work.
Are we close to... I know you said this before in one of the interviews I did with you, that, but you felt like there was going to be a landing and it would maybe collapse markets and change things. Do you think we're anywhere close to where we're going to have contact, direct contact, and public will be aware of it?
I am getting, it's very close. I would say 15 months is the information I'm getting psychically. And it has to do, you know, with an awareness, not only of Flatwoods and the movie that may be coming out, but it has, you know, something to do with the way that, if you want to put it, the stars are aligned and how we come into the age of Aquarius, which the two ages, Pisces and Aquarius, overlap. So when we become fully into the age of Aquarius, some people say we are now, some people will say 2021, but it to that point. So 15 months is what I'm saying.
Okay. Thank you very much for sharing that. That was wonderful. Frank, what else do you want to tell us about the story of the Flatwoods Monster? So it's the 67th anniversary. You did all this research, and the research continues. A lot of the people that you talked to have passed on, but there's still some that are still around, right?
Yeah, not many. Only a couple of them, TJ. But what Phil was talking about is the awareness and the public point of view on this. Over the years, I saw the attitude change of the public, and what was amazing to me is what would scare the hell out of some of the old-timers and the people who were involved with this incident and who were aware of it. The younger generation, the kids and the millennials, it was like nothing to them, TJ. They would see the picture of the reptilian out of the spacesuit in Frametown, and it would scare the hell out of the elders, and the young kids just looked at it and said, wow, that's cool. You know, and it's just, you could just see the attitude changing.
Maybe because they were being prepared.
Thought it was cool and great. Wow, I love that. And they were buying my posters and books like crazy, you know. But the old timers, you know, they're in that different mindset from back in the 50s and 60s. And
I think part of it. Part of it, Frank, also is that they're born into a greater awareness. That's what my research tells me, what my feeling tells me, what I see of these younger people is that they have more awareness. And also, they were exposed to so much more probably than even we were with everything that's out there. Would you agree on that as well, Phil or Frank?
I agree that some of our great minds get impressions from either any video games that you're associated with. It just expands it. But you have to look at the Flatwoods Monster has its own Pokemon card. So that's the generation coming up, you know.
That's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. So
and then there's about 50 different kinds of toys modeled after the monster. None of them are correct because I own all the copyrights on the actual rendition from working with the witnesses of what it looked like. But the biggest misconception, TJ, is it was a hokey monster wearing a dress with claws and arms waving around that terrorized the witnesses, and it floated and all that kind of silly stuff, which is a stretch from the truth.
And then also they were trying to excuse it away as being an owl as well. And that was what some of the early reports, they say, oh, it was nothing just but an owl.
Yeah, and an owl in a tree about 12 feet up in the air, and the underbrush and tree gave the impression of a monster.
Now, these beings we've talked about before, Frank, and you and I have speculated, and Phil has also talked about this with us, and he said they were benevolent. But we believe, you kind of believe this, that they showed up because we were doing some kind of war games just prior to this event, because they were keeping it so we wouldn't destroy the planet. They were kind of keeping an eye on us. Is that kind of your theory behind why they were here?
Yeah, they've been watching this for years. T.J. Donald Keough wrote about this back in the 50s. They were seen over strategic military areas, atomics, and nuclear sites, and stuff was going on. I think just from reading and researching is what Keough had talked about, and that is the Air Force wanted one of these crafts, and they were going to do anything in their power to take them down. And what we talked about off the air a little bit earlier about, is there a possibility that the Roswell craft was shot down? There is. And Donald Keough actually talked about that and made a quote back in 1947. And I'm going to take a second here. And Keough wrote of Donald Keough, Major Keough, retired United States Marine Corps officer. He said, on June 27, 1947, the Air Force stated, "We have no idea what they are. Seriously concerned, they ordered their pilots to shoot down a UFO for examination by shooting or by ramming and bailing out." So this is back in 1947, and Keough's writings throughout the years, he talks about this extensively. He even talks about how some of them were taken down, but, you know, from his sources inside the Pentagon. He was a friend of Donald was of Charles Lindbergh, who flew the first transatlantic flight, and he actually traveled around the country with Lindbergh promoting aviation. So he was involved with some heavy hitters, and he was actually a thorn in the government side, but he knew all the bigwigs, for lack of better words, in the Pentagon and in the Air Force. So he was able to get a lot of information that we didn't have, and some of that included the Flatwoods Monster case, where he spoke to some of the officers at the Pentagon about the Flatwoods incident. And it was taken as a joke at first until Keough started writing about it. Then I pieced everything together with what he wrote about, some of the things Colonel Levitt told me, what Mrs. May told me, Freddie May, and so on and so forth. So this has been like a puzzle over 25 years of putting all this together. And even just up until a few years ago, TJ, some of the stuff didn't make sense to me. Like, for instance, Colonel Levitt, I interviewed him in the early 90s before he died, and he was telling me information I had no idea what the hell he was talking about. And then years later, I would find another piece of documentation, or Stanton would send me something, or somebody would talk to me, and I'm like, wow, now it makes sense. And I would pull my old tapes back out of Colonel Levitt, and the same thing with A. Lee Stewart Jr. He passed away in 96. He told me stuff I didn't know what he was talking about. And then as I started researching further and further into the case and getting more information out, then I was able to go, aha, that's what they were talking about. That's another reason why it took so many years, TJ. I had so much information, I didn't know how it fit into the puzzle. But eventually, it all came together.
Are there things still that you have that you haven't figured out yet? Do you still have some information that you're still scratching your head over?
Not really, TJ. I was after my first book came out in 2004, I found more information out, because you know what happened? Doing shows like yours, I was reaching the masses around the world, and people were sending me information. I just got one last week, as a matter of fact, an email of a guy who had read my book, and he told me a little bit more about the radio stations and the television stations up in the 50s, up in Braxton County in West Virginia. You know, just every little piece of detail helps and adds to it. But I was able to figure most of it out. Like I said, I worked with a lot of people, TJ, the ones who were willing to help. I had a lot of retired Air Force guys back out.
What do you make of
this thing was, I had a a few years ago, one meeting arranged here in Volusia County, and he was a fighter jet pilot. He flew F-94 Starfires, and he kind of, I don't think he had any idea of the amount of research I had. And when I started talking to him on the phone, he ended up a couple of days later, he backed out mysteriously at the last minute, which has happened to me for over 25 years. A lot of people don't want to get involved in this, TJ, but I was lucky enough to work with a lot of fellas from the Korean War era, a couple guys, World War II era, and a lot of Vietnam vets. I work with air traffic controllers who were in Korea and also in Vietnam. And when I got involved in the missing case with Jones and Del Curto, the missing F-94 Starfire that happened on September 12th, a lot of those guys pulled together and worked with me, and we were able to figure out the flight paths and the trajectories, and we got more documents, and I worked with Stanton Friedman, and that was several years just pulled away from Flatwoods working on this missing jet, which in the end, it was a piece of the puzzle that fit right into the whole storyline.
You know, we didn't really talk about the pilots, but how many, is there a number of pilots? Do you know if there's a certain number of pilots that went down during those incident, that those days when those, they were trying to attack those UFOs, and these UFOs were certainly not trying to shoot them down. They were basically just defending themselves. But any idea how many lives were lost?
I don't know, TJ, and we may never know. You're talking about September 12th, right?
Yeah, around that time period. And then, of course, you said for many years after that, the government kind of declared war on these things, and we lost. Didn't you tell me we lost more pilots after the Korean War than we did during the whole Korean War?
Yes. That was in my book, Shoot 'Em Down. What I did is I used the New York Times as my database between 1951 and 56, and I wrote a chapter called The Six Deadly Years. And during those few years of going through the archives, I was able to establish that there was 200 fighter aircraft incidents where the aircraft were destroyed. And 19 of those aircraft had vanished over the United States, and 35 men vanished over the United States, vanished over foreign countries. So worldwide, 42 men, which were radar operators and pilots, who disappeared. So there were actually, out of the 200 fighter aircraft accident incidents, TJ, there were 231 fighter aircraft destroyed. 188 occurred over the United States and 43 around the world. And there was of those 188, 181 were non-trainers. And several of these guys were combat veterans. We could probably do a whole show, TJ, just on the crazy stories that happened, multiple jet accidents. There was 13 multiple jet crashes and 13 cases where between 2 and 4 jets went down and or vanished into thin air. And 11 of them were Air Force. Then we have all the World War II, and this is, you have to figure back in 52, that's during the Korean War era, there was a lot of World War II pilots who had transitioned into flying jets as well. And I was able to find that there was 20 of these cases here in the New York Times. There were 20 fighter combat veterans that died, and they all died over the United States. Hmm. They mysteriously crashed or mysteriously vanished. And the top 9 fellas that I was able to find out information about them, and the amount of combat missions that were within those articles, TJ. There was 9 men, all combat vets, who accounted for 885 combat missions in World War II and or Korea. 885 combat missions, and these 9 guys either vanished into thin air or mysteriously crashed over the United States.
They survived all those battles. and then they something brought them down here. So it supports the theory that they were involved in some kind of... And you feel also that these craft weren't trying to attack our people deliberately, or were there other craft here that maybe were malevolent? Is there any feel of that? And Phil, you can chime in too if you don't mind.
Well, I would say there are some malevolent kind of aircraft out there. I mean, that has to do with the yin and the yang of the universe. I mean, everybody remembers seeing the fifth element, and you look at how benevolent craft and malevolent craft. So there are other species who either need something from Earth or is conquer and destroy.
But when you look at from the angle that the Air Force wanted one of these, they were sending their guys after them, TJ. If you can't talk them down, shoot them down.
They wanted the technology.
And so were some of these, were a lot of these incidents, you feel, created by these craft just defending themselves?
I would say yes.
Go ahead.
There's another thing that, you know, we have to also assume the possibility of interdimensional travel, and that some of these missing aircraft could have been chasing one of these UFOs and whoops, goes into a time slip.
And so they're not going to be able to find their way back, or what happened?
Yeah, that is correct. Or craft themselves assimilated them.
Okay. So some of them could actually still be alive, kind of like what it said in Close Encounters?
That is correct.
And maybe someday they'll land over by Devil's Tower, and then they'll come back, they'll come marching out. Richard Dreyfuss will come running out.
Yeah. Well, I got to tell you about interdimensional just time slips and stuff. I was up in Maine, and I had a lady who had visited for, I guess, some spiritual counseling. And we were talking, and she said that she had a blanket that she got in a city in Maine. She went into it, and it's an old-fashioned blanket. She went into this old antique store, talked to an old lady, and picked out this, I guess, rug. I guess it's not a blanket, but a rug. And so she purchased it and then put it in her car, and she forgot to thank the lady. So she went back to the store where she bought it, but the store wasn't there. It was just a carpenter working in the store, fixing it up. And the lady says, well, I was just here. Where's the store? And the carpenter said, nobody's been in this store for 5 years. It's closed.
Wow.
You know. But she has the blanket, and she brought it in for me to see, or the rug. So.
That is way cool. That's really neat.
Yeah.
So, what did you feel about it, Phil? This is the first time I heard about this story. I told you, I know Phil, and there's a lot of stuff he forgets to tell me or he doesn't. So what happened, Phil? What did you feel on it? She walked into a time warp?
She did.
Phil extracted this blanket and went back, and the place wasn't there. So how did that happen? Is there a time rip over that store or something?
Yeah, just for her being there, I guess she needed that rug. So, but I felt the rug, it really had a lot of warm energy in it.
What does that mean?
It's one of those, it's got an energy to it of, if you really want to meditate, that's the rug you want to meditate on.
Could you tell how old that rug was?
It was from the, what I would call 1790s.
Mm. That's old.
I like
so
it.
So was that
go ahead.
A 1790 store she walked
no,
into?
No, it was an antique store.
Oh, an antique store, okay.
Well, technically, what she thought it was, but really it wound up being a store that was much older than that, right?
Yeah, that is correct. So
that's interesting you bring up that story. I interviewed a guy from England. He told me, I don't know, I think I saw my, he had my my podcast linked to his site. And I was curious, and I said, really? He goes, yeah, I like some of the interviews you do. And then he started telling me that he had some experiences which would be similar to what you're saying, but he said he actually, the walls of his apartment melted away, and he started walking down the street in a different time period, which he believed was at least almost 100 years prior. And he was interacting with people that were there before he came back. So we have these, because it's all playing out at the same time, isn't it?
Yeah, that is correct. So that's just a, you know, interdimensional walkway for him there. But if anybody's gone to Gettysburg, you know, there's lots of stories like that.
Interesting.
That people will actually see the battle unfolded in front of them. And there was also a gentleman who was in a army, in a Union uniform, and the person thought that they were in some type of reenactment, and the person gave him some bullets, but those bullets were actually dated into the 1860s.
Oh, yeah. I heard that too. I heard that story. He thought, because they were doing a reenactment, these two guys, and they came across a Union soldier, and he said, hey, you guys need some bullets. And he gave them the bullets, and they were looking, this guy is really authentic. And then they realized that these were bullets that went back to the 1800s, which would have been issued during the Civil War. So it's kind of like, do you think some of these visitors, Frank or Dr. Phil, are they coming from another time period? You say whether they're interdimensional, perhaps, or from a different planet. Do you think any of those that are visiting us are coming from another time period to even our own future?
Well, you have to look at the time-space continuum. So theoretically, you know, we're in this infinity symbol, and in the center is the now, and then anything can be from the future or from the past. But if we do have that interdimensional time warp, then there is a purpose that person's coming through for.
Do you think the beings that showed up in the Flatwoods incident were interdimensional from another planet or from another time period or all of the above?
All of the above.
Really?
They kind of, when they're traveling through time and space, the technology that their spacecraft have can rip through, you know, different portals and affect that time-space continuum. So if you're saying, are they coming from the future? That is what I'm seeing, that they're coming from the future because they want to help humanity to overcome our weaknesses, which is just fear based ego monetary stuff.
Frank, are you still with us? What do you think about all this? Where do you think these beings come from?
TJ, I have no idea, but if I ever find out, you'll be the first one to know, and it'll be another book to come out and update. I don't know, but all I know is there were several of them that got damaged that night. And what a surprise that must have been when they had rockets shot at them.
Right.
And Phil and I were talking about this a couple of weeks ago. A lot of people don't believe that because the crafts were so advanced that our rockets or bullets couldn't have taken them down. But Phil could probably explain this better than myself. has something to do with them coming into a heavier, thicker atmosphere from what they're used to. So it's going to be a little bit different where they're traveling, you know, once they get through into our dimension. Maybe they went slower. Maybe their ships were sluggish. I don't know. But Phil mentioned something about it to me.
Yeah, it has to do with our atmosphere. It has to do with that, is it the Van Arden belt that, you know, protects us?
Van Allen? Is it Van Allen or belt?
Van Allen belt. So I think once they go through there, their ships have to adjust somehow into our atmosphere. And I think some of them have already perfected that, so they can just zip through it. Probably with the Flatwoods Monster, takes a little bit of adjustment to the atmosphere that Frank's talking about.
You know, you wonder
when they get to the atmosphere, they have to adjust.
Yep.
And they're sitting off the eastern seaboard, adjusting their craft, and next thing they're getting fired on.
Well, and you know, you don't hear about that as much today, that we're able to fire, because we have much better weapons nowadays, and bring craft down. So you wonder if that was kind of a learning curve for them back then, and have they kind of figured it out over the last several decades? How do you feel about that?
Could be, TJ. I just have to go by what I've uncovered and the knowledge that I have, but something that I found out recently about these Mighty Mouse rockets, the 2.75s rockets that they were firing, they were advanced for their day. They were actually brought about and invented by the United States Navy in the late 40s. And they also had a proximity fuse, which means that this thing would explode, the high explosive warhead, when it merely passed by a target. It didn't have to have a direct hit. So this thing had TNT in the warhead, so if it just flew by that vicinity, it would explode. Didn't have to make direct contact. And I said this on a couple radio shows, and some of the listeners, I think, weren't paying attention when I said, imagine hundreds of rockets flying around the sky, and at these UFOs making direct hits or with their proximity fuses. And some guy made a comment about those rockets didn't have hundreds. Those jets didn't have hundreds of rockets. Each one of these in combination lighting up the sky like fireworks, that these UFOs shooting hundreds of them and bullets flying around, it would have looked like the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. And we know back in the record books, the Air Force wanted one of these UFOs. And when they showed up over Flatwoods, we traced the trajectory of the Flatwoods Monster craft. And TJ, it actually flew over Washington, D.C., and at certain parts across the eastern seaboard at treetop level with pieces falling off of it. And when we tracked the path from Flatwoods over Front Royal, Virginia, it actually passed right over the heart of Washington, D.C., and it flew out over the eastern seaboard. And it was in the ADIZ zone for the Atlantic Ocean, the Atlantic Air Defense Identification Zone. So this craft and the two other ones that were out there were actually shot off the coast and flew inland on western trajectories. The first one flew down towards Tennessee, and it actually flew through the no-fly zone of Oak Ridge National Laboratory. The second craft flew up towards Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. That passed over Baltimore. That's the research that Ivan Sanderson had done. I just went further. I knew where it passed over previous and subsequent. Then we have the third craft, and that's where everybody missed the boat when they never looked outside of Flatwoods. This thing didn't drop straight out of outer space. on a vertical descent and just landed flat woods. We retraced it going back over the eastern seaboard. And I was also told by a retired Air Force guy who was stationed up there at that time, he said, the United States Air Force, as well as the Marines, we owe a Navy, we always had our best jets surrounding Washington, D.C. So the state-of-the-art jets were around Washington, which makes sense. Now you get UFOs showing up in a no-fly zone just off the coast of the United States directly across from Washington. That's a threat to the country. So they sent their best jets up. As a matter of fact, the F-94C Starfire, the Lockheed jet, was not used in Korea during that time, TJ, because the United States government was scared if this thing had crashed and the Russians have got hold of our technology, that would have compromised our superiority. So the F-94C Starfires were never flown in Korea. They were always kept stateside, and the majority of them were kept to surround the Washington area and up and down the eastern seaboard as well. So this makes sense when we found out that how many of these UFOs were along the eastern seaboard. Until one of the last sightings at night, that night at Flatwood, September 12th, there was a gigantic craft that was sitting off the coast near Delaware, and it was picked up by the United States Air Force, and it was sighted visually, and the thing had dropped and flown just to a couple thousand feet above the ground, and it was said to be the size of a dirigible, which is the size of a Zeppelin or a blimp. And at that point, that's when we believed, the people I researched with, that this was the mother craft, something of that size, and the objects were seen flying towards it. So we have a lot of information of what had actually occurred over Flatwoods and within the different Project Blue Book and local newspapers where there were sightings. There were also sightings of jets and airplanes, which we can't go any further and find anything out, you know, any deeper. But there were aircraft seen up and down the United States, the seaboard that night. And there was actually another jet that crashed over the Gulf of Mexico about the same time as the Del Curto case and John Jones, the one I researched for years. And that case was an abomination in itself, how much was uncovered, how much was missing. Stanton Friedman, speaking of Stanton, he actually was at the National Archives after I got the Jones and Del Curto aircraft accident report. And that was diluted and blacked out, and it was a shortened version with documents missing. And Stanton contacted me when he got home from the National Archives, and he was researching the aircraft accident reports. And the 1952 September aircraft accidents were missing from the box at the archives. Out of all the years, the September 52 documents were gone. And when Stanton was sifting around, he found a bunch of stuff that was not categorized or cataloged. And he actually found the Jones and Del Curto preliminary case that was ripped out of the files from the original aircraft report, which was not in the microfilm files. Yet Stanton found it tucked away, mixed in a box of mess of uncatalogued stuff. So God only knows where these documents went. And can you imagine how many other cases are the same way?
Yeah, I'm sure there's, you know, when if and when the date comes, and I believe it will, that we will, not only will we, you know, we're all going to be coming into, and I want your input too on this, Dr. Phil, and then we're going to wrap it up pretty soon, but I believe we're coming into a greater time of awareness, a greater time of psychic ability. I don't know how long it's going to take, but we're maybe not even going to really need documents to support things. We're just all going to kind of know, because the truth, we're going to have the ability to see it and sense it and know it and then people will speak clearly. Do you feel that that is going to come at some point, Dr. Phil, and will that be any time within hopefully our lifetime?
Yes, that is going to occur. It has to do with group consciousness and the way that psychically and spiritually how things have been evolving. And when you look at spiritualism or, you know, phenomena in that regard, in the 1800s to the mid-1900s, it was basically physical phenomena. Again, it was observe, evaluate, prove everything. And then it more or less got into what you call mental mediumship or telepathy and things like that, whereas people, you know, are like a mentalist pulling stuff out of the universe. But now we're getting to an awareness where it's all a group consciousness and we can telepathically pick up everything and just know the truth.
That's what I was saying. And do you foresee that, how much further do we, well, it's a tough question to answer, but how far away are we, if you had to put an estimate on it, from really being fully immersed in that?
20 years is what I'm seeing.
Okay.
There are a lot of barriers that have to be broken.
Okay. Well, I thank both of you guys for your insight. And Frank, again, you have all the facts, more facts than, I mean, it would take hours if you brought all of it up, wouldn't it?
Probably weeks, TJ. Well, look, we've been talking for about 10 years.
Right.
And there's still to talk about.
I know.
Right?
Every time you talk, I go, okay, I don't remember that. Maybe I'm just forgetting, but I don't remember Frank bringing that up before. And then it's nice to hear your perspective, Dr. Phil, because you and I think, are on a similar understanding of how we see things. And Frank maybe doesn't really go down this road as much, but it's cool that you guys are friends. But I like your perspective as well, because I can ask you questions that connect to, you know, this, what I see things as happening. This is all part of a bigger picture, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And Frank, his psychic abilities are awakening.
Whether he admits it or not?
Yep, I can see it. So.
And now I'm driving Dr. Phil crazy because the stuff that's happening with me, I'm like, how did I know that? Do this or do that, and it's like, Phil says that because you're hanging around me. And I am not trained in this psychic and metaphysical field whatsoever. And I'm learning stuff every day. Every time I talk to Phil, he said, even today, I learned something new.
Yeah, it's amazing. Well, I love having you guys on, and I hope you come on again. We don't have to wait as long. You're welcome back anytime. And we can talk about other things as well, because we had some interesting conversations off the air before we started. And I'd like to go any number of directions. So anytime you want, you guys are like brothers to me. I'm glad I had a chance to talk to both of you today.
Thanks again, TJ.
Thank you, TJ.